With everything you have on your plate, earning your degree online seems impossible. But at Grand Canyon University, we specialize in helping you fit a master's degree in business into your busy day. Your graduation team, led by your own GCU counselor, provides you with the personal support you need to succeed. Achieve your goals with a plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
From the studios of the Stone Independent School in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, as well as Messiah College among the free-willing markets of Grantham, Pennsylvania, this is the Way of Improvement Leads Home podcast, a bi-weekly discussion dedicated to American history, historical thinking, and the role of history in our everyday lives. And now, here's your host, author and award-winning historian, John Fia.
Thank you, Drew, and welcome everyone to episode 55 of the Way of Improvement Leads Home podcast. Drew, we are recording this in mid-September. How are things going with the new high school history teacher?
They're going great, and I can't think of a better episode to wrap up my first mod with. Like I said last episode, our mods are very short. So the last day of my first term is this coming Monday. But wow. my class on isms is really focused on the exact topic, or at least some of the topics we're going to be talking about today. It is worth noting, I am also teaching at Messiah College, and not only am I teaching, I'm teaching the same class you're teaching.
That's right.
At Messiah College.
Yeah.
So how about you, John? How is that early American survey going, that first half of the U.S. survey going, that we're both co-teaching? Well, we're not co-teaching. We're teaching separately.
Just out of curiosity, where are you? Like, what's your next lecture, next topic?
We'll be analyzing in class runaway slave advertisements. One of the differences here is I'm teaching once a week, whereas you're teaching at a more normal pace.
Right.
We will be wrapping up kind of early colonialism and moving towards the revolutionary age the next week.
That's about where I'm at. So we're in good shape. I'm finishing up doing some things with Ben Franklin's autobiography, and then we move on to sort of the Stamp Act and all of those kinds of things.
So remind me again, who's the other autobiography you often use to compare with Ben Franklin?
Oh, I love using William Morelli, The Infortunate, story of a guy who actually comes to America around the same time as Franklin and doesn't, quote unquote, make it, right?
Right. So I think I'm going to have my students compare those two. We're doing something a little bit different because I have 3 hours with them every week.
Yeah,
I'm really
yeah.
giving them their primary source analysis in class and then breaking into groups and working on those together and then kind of coming back and presenting their work to the rest of the class and generating discussion that way. It's been working pretty well so far.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever taught the survey, at least here at Messiah, in a 3 hour section. So you got to do some different things, right, to keep the ball moving.
Absolutely. But you're also teaching a different course that is shaping up to be pretty exciting. Tell me a little something about Spit in a Verse in your Age of Hamilton course.
There you go. I'm taking my shot, as my wife told me. I'm teaching this Age of Hamilton course. I think it's going really well. I've been getting some positive feedback from the students. We spent the first maybe 5 or 6 or 7 classes talking about Lin-Manuel Miranda's Broadway play as history, or debating whether or not it's history and how we should think about it in terms of history. And now we're finally just starting to dive into the early life of Hamilton. So we're doing some West Indian history, giving the students some context for his life, talking a little bit about slavery, talking a little bit about the sugar plantations of the West Indies. So, yeah, it's been really fun. I'm enjoying it. I think the students are enjoying it. They occasionally break out into song when I play different parts of the musical. So I guess that's always a good sign.
That's awesome. And I kind of wish I could go back in time and take that class myself.
Well, if you weren't such a busy man, Drew, I'd invite you to sit in.
Yeah.
But, I get it.
So what can we expect from this episode of the podcast?
We are going to do some more economic history today. Our guest is Cornell University historian Lawrence Glickman. He has a brand new book out on the history of the idea of quote unquote free enterprise in the United States. And he traces the history of free enterprise from the 19th century all the way up to the present. It's a really interesting book.
Yeah. I mean, again, as I mentioned, I have a student currently working on a white paper on libertarianism in my ISMS class, and I really feel like this could be a great resource, and maybe I need to make a last minute pitch to at least go out and find a copy of this book so that he can add it to his paper. But because I don't think I've ever seen the concept historicized the way Glickman has.
Yeah, and he really does try to sort of show the way in which this idea of free enterprise changes over time, and I think that's a really, really valuable contribution. Glickman's really good at showing how free enterprise became such a mantra for the right. And then he even reflects at the end of the book on whether or not Donald Trump is a free market advocate. And I think I'm going to ask him something about that if we have time during the interview. But generally, I think our listeners are really going to enjoy this interview. And it's an interesting topic. It's a topic that actually we've touched on here and there, as I'm going to mention here in a few minutes in my commentary. But before we get to that and before we get to Glickman, Drew, tell us how to connect with the Way of Improvement Leads Home podcast.
The Way of Improvement Leads Home is a proud member of the Recorded History Podcast Network. Head to recordedhistory.net to check out some of our fellow network podcasts. Our podcast is brought to you through the generous donations of Lisa DeGuardi, Richard Green, Ron Schooler, Kate Logan, Margaret Graves, and Gretchen Adams. And as always, many thanks to Jennings College Consulting, discovering the right college fit for your future. If you want to become a sponsor of the show, please head over to thewayofimprovement.com and click support. And the best way to spread the word about the podcast is to tell a friend. And if you want to follow us on social media, you can find us at TWOILH Podcast on Twitter and Facebook. And please consider giving us a positive review on iTunes or Stitcher.
Yeah, thank you again so much. Like I say every episode, thank you so much to all of those who support us. Again, we could really use your financial support as well. If you want to head over to our Patreon site and donate there, you can find links on the blog, thewayofimprovement.com. We are excited. Can't reveal too much right now, but we have some really good guests already lined up for the next couple episodes here in season 6.
So before we get to our interview with Lawrence Glickman, you have some things to say first, John.
In his book, The History of Free Enterprise, our guest today, Cornell's Lawrence Glickman, discusses the faith that many conservatives and libertarians have in the free enterprise system. According to this view, free markets are miracles. Their defenders believe they will, if applied consistently, magically end poverty or bring racial reconciliation. Or uphold the Enlightenment values of liberty and freedom that have come to define our country, or at least the way many of us talk about our country. Free enterprise advocates defend free enterprise with a religious zeal. In fact, a significant portion of free enterprise defenders are Christians. As several historians have shown us in recent years, these Christians, many of whom identify in some way as evangelical Christians, have made free enterprise an essential part of their worldview. Historians Amanda Porterfield and Darren Grimm have suggested that there has been a quote-unquote business turn in current interpretations of American religious history. Americans committed to the authority of the Bible, the centrality of the cross, the need for a born-again conversion, and the mandate to share their faith with others have long turned to business interests to promote their religious and cultural message. For example, historian Kevin Cruz, who you may recall from episode 34 of this podcast, has shown how American businessmen enlisted evangelicals and other religious activists in the middle of the 20th century to challenge the New Deal and its legacy in order to make America free and Christian nation as they understood it. Check out his book if you haven't already, One Nation Under God, how corporate America invented Christian America. Similarly, Darren Grimm has suggested that American evangelicals have tried to, quote, serve God and mammon, unquote, for a long time. Christian preachers and politicians have used private enterprise and business techniques to strengthen evangelicalism's place in the larger culture. Check out his book, The Blessings of Business, How Corporations Shaped Conservative Christianity. And by the way, it is the best thing out there on the religion of Chick-fil-A. Some of you may remember our episode 51 interview with Nicole Kirk, author of a fascinating new book on religion and Philadelphia department store magnate John Wanamaker, titled Wanamaker's Temple, The Business of Religion in an Iconic Department Store. Wanamaker saw his department store as a kind of Christian ministry to spread the gospel and improve the religious character of his employees. And then in our next episode of the Way of Improvement Leads Home podcast, we will talk with Darren Dochuk, author of Anointed with Oil, How Christianity and Crude Made Modern America. As Dochuk writes on the dust jacket, quote, citizens saw oil as the nation's special blessing and its peculiar burden, the source of its prophetic mission in the world. The oil industry's leaders and its ordinary workers together fundamentally transformed American religion, business, and politics, boosting America's ascent as the preeminent global power, giving shape to modern evangelical Christianity, and fueling the rise of the Republican right. Dochuk's book should make for a really interesting conversation. Historian Timothy Gloge shows the influence of Quaker Oats president Henry Crowell in the work of Chicago's Moody Bible Institute. Some of you may recognize Moody as the flagship fundamentalist Bible school in America. Gloge writes, conservative evangelicalism and modern business grew symbiotically, transforming the ways that Americans worshiped, worked, and consumed. Gilded Age evangelicals initially understood themselves primarily as new Christian workers, employees of God guided by their divine contract, the Bible. Check out Gloge's Guaranteed Pure, The Moody Bible Institute, Business, and the Making of Modern Evangelicalism. And what would an overview of new work on business, free enterprise, and religion in America be without mentioning Walmart? Bethany Morton's book, To Serve God and Walmart, The Making of Christian Free Enterprise, shows how the history of this big box store, quote, uncovers a complex network that united Sunbelt entrepreneurs, evangelical employees, Christian business students, overseas missionaries, and free market activists, unquote. She concludes how Walmart's Christian service ethos powered capitalism at home and abroad. In the end, there is nothing in the Bible about free markets. The Bible does not extol an economic system to promote human flourishing. Christians are called to live out their faith in all kinds of economic arrangements, and history has shown us that this has indeed been the case. But many evangelicals seem to believe that government regulation, whether of the progressive movement variety, the New Deal variety, or the democratic socialist variety, is clearly not of God. The books that make up the business turn in American evangelicalism help us understand why.
Lawrence Glickman is the Stephen and Evelyn Millman Professor of American Studies at Cornell University. He is the author or editor of four books, including Buying Power, A History of Consumer Activism in America, published in 2009 with the University of Chicago Press. He writes on public affairs for Boston Review, Dissent, and other periodicals of opinion. At Cornell, he teaches a popular course on sports and politics in American history, and he is a core faculty member of the History of Capitalism Initiative. His most recent book, published last month with Yale University Press, is Free Enterprise, An American History.
Our guest today on the podcast is Lawrence B. Glickman. He is the author of Free Enterprise, An American History. Welcome to the program, Lawrence.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, John.
Now, let's start out here with the way you start your book. You start the book with an analysis of a famous document, and I have to confess, as an early American historian, I had never heard of the Powell Memorandum, but you start with this thing called the Powell Memorandum, and you call it one of the most notorious, quote unquote, the most notorious documents in U.S. history, unquote. So for people like me, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners who may not even know who Powell is, who is Powell? Why do you begin the book with his so-called document? And then maybe why is this document so notorious in your mind?
Right. Well, that's a great question, and it's an interesting story. And actually, in my first draft of the book, the chapter on the Powell Memo was the final chapter because chronologically, it's really the end of my story.
Well, that's interesting because I was going to save this question to the end, right?
Right.
I didn't want to tip, sort of make you give everything away with the first question. But yeah, go ahead.
But I'll tell you why I began with it, because Lewis Powell was a corporate lawyer, very well known. He had been president of the American Bar Association from Richmond, Virginia. He was soon to be appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court by Richard Nixon later in 1971. But in August of that year, he had lunch with a friend, a neighbor in Richmond, who was involved with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And that person asked him to write a memo about things that they had been discussing in their regular lunches and discussions over the years about the threat that American business faced and the threat that what they called the free enterprise system faced. And Powell spent a weekend with his secretary in his law office in Richmond, Virginia, writing this, I think it was a 34-page TypeScript memo called The Attack on the American Free Enterprise System. Right. And a lot of historians, this memo was confidential. No one knew about it for more than a year until the investigative reporter Jack Anderson broke the story about this memo. And there was a wave of controversy about it because Powell in that memo said that business was under attack, that the free enterprise system was endangered, and that what needed to happen was that business needed to get more politically involved. The business lobby needed to do a better job of defending its interest. Right. He made the point that businesses were very good at selling their individual products, but that they were very bad at selling, as it were, the economic system that he called the free enterprise system.
Right.
So that's what the document was about.
And then how do you kind of give a different interpretation of this document than sort of, I'm thinking most historians, but also kind of most sort of pundits who have sort of tried to wax eloquent about this document, right?
Exactly.
And you kind of almost downplay in some ways its significance. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The title, where, you know, the most notorious document in history, I'm drawing from what a lot of mostly journalists have said about it. A lot of journalists have made a huge deal about the Powell Memo as the crucial turning point in the rise of conservatism in America.
Yeah.
And the point I try to make in my book is that the Powell Memo was really the culmination of a four-decade campaign against the New Deal, that it was not really original at all, but it was what was really crucial about it was the timing. What I argue is that Powell said nothing that hadn't been said before, but he said it at the exact moment when what historians call the New Deal order was breaking up.
Yeah. And we'll get back to that New Deal discussion here in a second, because that's obviously kind of the centerpiece of much of your narrative here. But much of this book is just kind of a history of this term, free enterprise, and or this phrase. And you know, it's kind of got, you know, it's kind of got a slippery kind of definition. If I'm reading you correctly, it's often used kind of vaguely. Sort of people throughout, especially the 20th century, just kind of use it, and they assume everybody knows what it means. There's debates over whether or not it's the equivalent to something like laissez-faire. You know, so it's you trace this really, really well. But before we get into that kind of 20th century history. You go all the way back to think about the idea of free enterprise during the 19th century. And you argue that the phrase free enterprise in the 19th century was always understood in relationship or in the context of what historians like Eric Foner and others have talked about free labor, right? Talk about that relationship between free labor and free enterprise, if there is a relationship, in the 19th century?
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the things I really wanted to do in this book is to show that free enterprise, which is a term that we've all heard, we all sort of take for granted, right, but that it actually has an interesting history of evolution and contestation. And in the 19th century, you're exactly right, that free enterprise was often spoken about in tandem with what historians call the free labor ideology.
Right.
And what was really interesting is that historians often referred to something that they called the spirit of free enterprise.
Yeah.
Free enterprise was really an attribute that was necessary for the free labor system to flourish. And the idea was that the whole goal of American society was, how do we unlock the spirit of free enterprise?
Mm-hmm. Now, was the phrase free enterprise, you said that was actually used in the 19th century?
Yes.
That phrase itself. Yeah.
Absolutely. It was used, but its meaning was quite different. The idea of free enterprise as we understand it in the 20th century was, you know, I try to show quite different, even though when people talk about the traditional free enterprise system, as they often do, they kind of elide those important differences.
So what would, you're reading some kind of a publication, a journal or a magazine or something in the 19th century, you know, can you give us all a sort of context, you know, where this, you know, how this word free enterprise would show up in a particular way or in a particular debate or a particular discussion for those who might not be familiar with, free labor ideology?
Absolutely. Well, there are two ways, I would say. One is that the term was really popularized by abolitionists. And right. What they meant by free enterprise was businesses that were not dependent upon the labor of enslaved people. So when they talked about free enterprises, they meant businesses that were dependent on free wage labor. So that's
literally free enterprises.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. My last book on the history of consumer activism in America, one of my chapters was on abolitionist boycotts of slave-made goods. Mm-hmm. And I was really surprised to keep coming across the phrase free enterprise in that context. And that's one of the reasons I decided to write this book that was just published. But the other meaning of the term, probably even more frequent, was, as I mentioned, this idea of how do we unlock the spirit of free enterprise. And here, it really marks a sharp contrast with the 20th century, because oftentimes the discussion was, maybe if our community gets the government to build a canal, we'll be able to unlock the free enterprise of our citizens. Yeah. So it was often used as symbiotic with kind of the rise of a state that could produce infrastructure and make markets more accessible and more widespread.
Sure. Now, before we get to the New Deal, you also kind of talk about the way this term is used in the progressive era. How was that? Was You know, how is that any different than, say, our modern understanding of the term that we often hear today in conservative or libertarian circles? And, you know, was the progressive era closer to the use of the term in the progressive era closer to the 19th century definition, or was it sort of foreshadowing kind of what was to come?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the progressive era was really kind of the turning point. It was almost exactly between the two ways. It didn't really have the modern meaning that we're about to talk about, but progressives did begin to talk about free enterprise as sort of a broad economic system in a way that in the 19th century they didn't, because as we've said before, the 19th century was really the century of free labor. And in the progressive era, they began to talk about, you know, this is when people began to talk about we are a business civilization, and free enterprise began to reflect, I think, the idea that rather than the individual proprietor, that America was a country becoming more and more dependent on the business firm.
So would, you know, the kind of progressives, you know, I'm thinking of not only the presidents, but, you know, people like muckrakers and so forth. Would they have necessarily kind of targeted business interests in the way, say, that, you know, maybe like a progressive, like a Bernie Sanders today or Elizabeth Warren might target free enterprise? Or was it still kind of unclear, you know, who their targets were? Maybe they weren't using the phrase free enterprise.
Yeah, they didn't use it all that often. Woodrow Wilson used it a lot. I don't think muckrakers use it that much, but they certainly did think that that business corruption was a major problem. And, you know, that led to some ironic consequences that I can talk about later. But they did identify this relatively new issue.
Sure, sure. So then let's fast forward a little bit into the 1930s and the kind of 30s and 40s. And you argue that our kind of modern understanding of free enterprise, I think I mentioned this before, right? We normally associate this with pro-business, you know, keeping government and business separate, you know, again, laissez-faire, although that's, I know you've complicated that a little bit, or at least the people who defended free enterprise complicate that, you know, conservative kind of values. You argue that this kind of modern understanding of free enterprise really emerges in response to FDR and the New Deal. So what was the argument that these defenders of free enterprise made in their criticism of the New Deal? And I guess in the process of answering this question, I guess, you know, define for us the way people use free enterprise today, because it's obviously birthed in this time period.
Right. I do think the modern way in which many people use it today was began during the New Deal era. And I would say that the key to free enterprise was that, as we've said before, as you mentioned earlier, free enterprise itself was sort of a vague phrase that was quite hard to define in positive terms, but it was easy to define in negative terms. Yeah. And free enterprise really emerged as an other to the New Deal, an opposite of the New Deal. Both Republicans and conservative Southern Democrats really latched onto this idea in opposition to the New Deal. And basically what they feared was that what Franklin Roosevelt, the president during the period of the New Deal, called New Deal liberalism. Mm-hmm. So Roosevelt basically recaptured the phrase liberalism, which meant something pretty different before he did this. And he said, you know, New Deal liberalism means the mixed economy. It means the state regulating business. It means public spending. It means trade unions. It means all the things that we associate with a modern welfare state.
And this is the way we think about a sort of liberal today, right?
Exactly.
Ted Kennedy or, you know, somebody like that. Yeah,
exactly. So Roosevelt really invented that phrase. And in opposition, free enterprisers said a number of things. I would say the three keys to the discourse, which I think is very familiar for anyone who follows conservative discourse today, is that it was binary. So either you have free enterprise and freedom, or you have slavery. It was slippery slope, which is that New Deal liberals claim to be reformers and meliorists, but ultimately New Deal liberalism is bound to become totalitarian in some form, because once state power starts to grow, it's really impossible to hold it back. And the third thing that follows from the first two is that it was apocalyptic, very, very inflammatory language, very fearful language that I think all of it very familiar today.
Yeah, the I was going to ask you about that. The fear keeps coming up in your book, and it is this kind of, right, we're at the, you hear this in contemporary politics today on whatever the issue might be, right, from conservatives, whether it be social issues or something, or even the threat of socialism, right? We're on the cliff, right? Or we're, we're one Supreme Court justice away from this, or we're the whole American experiment is about to crumble if we allow the free enterprise system to somehow collapse. Why do you think I was really interested in this binary argument, right? And you argue, right, it's either there's no middle ground. It's black and white. We'll regulate a little bit, right? It's either all or nothing. What is going on there? What is the, why are they so kind of Manichaean, almost, like, by, about this, like not giving an inch?
Yeah, that's a great question, because, one of the points I try to make is that Franklin Roosevelt and many other New Deal liberals tried to reclaim free enterprise for themselves. Roosevelt said, I'm really saving free enterprise. We need a mixed economy if capitalism is to survive. What happened with the Great Depression was that government was too weak and business was too strong. We need to rejigger that relationship a little bit. But the opponents really had this idea that the New Deal was a stalking horse, a Trojan horse, wolf in sheep's clothing. This was the language they used. And that one of the things that they said repeatedly, which surprised me a little bit, is that the real danger wasn't, say, Soviet communism. There wasn't going to be a Soviet takeover of America. The real danger was internal subversion, which a lot of it might be not planned, but just the result of this slippery slope of people being more and more comfortable with government taking over, what the individual used to have control over. And they really feared that there would be very little possibility to put a brake on this. And you find so much language about this. Your question about why is a great one. I'm not sure my book entirely answers the why question, but it certainly answers, it certainly gives a lot of evidence that this was a very widespread fear.
Yeah, there's so much comparison here, and I'm not going to ask you to comment on this, but there's so much comparison between the kind of evangelicals that I study and their support of Trump, the fear of the collapse of, we're going to lose liberty, whether it be religious liberty or freedom. I mean, in some ways, this seems like it's not just a kind of, we prefer one economic system, free enterprise, over something else, but it's macro, right? I mean, the whole American experiment is going to fall apart because freedom, as they understand it, is rooted in, this kind of free enterprise system. Is that fair to say?
That's exactly right. I mean, what I say in my book is that policy battles became existential battles. And, one of the things when I began to research and write this book was around the time of the debates about Obamacare in 2009 and 10. And I remember thinking, like, that these debates are so reflective of the history I'm studying, where, Obama's saying, this is a kind of a step in this direction. We certainly don't want to alienate people in the business community and so forth. But so many critics, just didn't see that there was any possible middle ground there.
Now you also talk about, in relationship to this kind of battle or this war between free enterprise and new dealers. You know, you phrase it a few times as a kind of, and you reflect on it as a sort of battle of ideas, right? And there's a sense in which, even as I think today, right, it's, you know, a lot of the, I know the left has think tanks and, you know, these kinds of things, but the right and the free enterprise, whether it be the American Enterprise Institute or one of these other places, they've made this a war over ideas. And I know it's complicated, but you actually suggest they may have actually came out on top in that war of ideas over free enterprise, right?
Yes, I think that's right. I think that one of the things about free enterprise rhetoric is that it was repetitive, it was constant, it was consistent over a very long period of time. And even though they lost many policy battles, I do think they won the broader battle of what I call common sense.
Right.
And so I think, you know, it's an interesting question we may talk about later about whether that era of free enterprise is coming to an end right now. But yeah, I think certainly over the course of the 20th century, free enterprise ideas became dominant. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Yeah, I was thinking about, you know, maybe it was like 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, you know, this radio and television pundit, Glenn Beck, you know, was defending the free enterprise system. He actually wrote a book called Common Sense,
right?
In which he extolled the, you know, the free enterprise system and the threats. So it's again, all very, very, very relevant. Now let's talk. I mean, we've already been kind of talking a little bit, Lawrence, about the political ramifications of this, but you argue that these free enterprise advocates, with their kind of fear of the New Deal and FDR, their intellectual kind of, whether it be Hayek or later Friedman or someone like that, Milton Friedman, you know, with their sort of intellectual defenses of the free enterprise system, you argue that they create a sort of new political type in America. What do you mean by that? And you know, kind of how does the free enterprise system end up in the kind of GOP or the right or the conservative movement?
Yeah, that's a great question. I guess the way I would say it is that probably the biggest surprise I had is when I began researching this, I really thought of free enterprise as largely an economic topic.
Yeah.
But advocates of free enterprise really thought about it much more broadly. And I would say that, you know, the keys to the discourse were as much psychological as an emotional as economic or political.
Yeah,
and that the idea that I call elite victimization, which is that these tended to be, objectively powerful people, mostly white men in the middle or upper classes, believed that their livelihoods, that their position in society, that the whole culture was in this very dangerous point and that they needed to fight against it. And I, you know, that's so familiar to us with the way political rhetoric, especially on the right, has moved these days. So
this populism, right? It was just what you're describing, right? So how much, I don't know if you touch on this in the book or not, but this thought came to my head. You know, how much too was this a kind of populist resistance to, you know, you think about the New Deal and you think about it's these intellectuals, it's the brain trust, it's, you know, it's these, you know, we've entrusted our economy to these intellectuals who don't like free markets or, you know, whatever. How much do you think it's that in terms of this kind of elites, right? This resistance to elites, this kind of populism.
Yeah, it's very, very powerful. I mean, I call it a kind of inverted populism because it really, but I think it was very much an anti-elitist language, often spoken by elites, nonetheless, very fiercely spoken in the name of the people.
Right, right. Drew, you had a question, I think.
Who was Leonard Reed and why was his essay I Pencil so important to the history of free enterprise in the United States?
Yeah, Leonard Reed is one of the one of the characters that I had the most fun writing about. He's a type of figure that I really like writing about because he was not an intellectual, but a popularizer. So he was the founder of one of the first think tanks in 1946 that I guess today we would call a libertarian think tank called the Foundation for Economic Education. Before that, he had worked for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in various places. He was a charming person, a fantastic cook, someone who cultivated a lot of famous and popular people, including Hayek, the economist that John mentioned earlier. But what he really wanted to do was to sell what he called the freedom philosophy, which was very much akin to the idea of free enterprise. And his most famous essay was this very unusual history of a pencil from the point of view of a pencil. He called it the autobiography of a pencil. Mm-hmm. And the essay called iPencil was published in 1958. It's one that many, many people still read today in high school and college curricula. And the whole point of the essay, which is quite elegant, is that nobody can make a pencil, that no mastermind, no command economy could make a pencil, that the pencil is a function of the actions of millions of people coordinated only by the free market. That's really the essence of the essay. And it is often repeated, sometimes plagiarized, often Reed doesn't get credit for it. Milton Friedman's very popular TV series called Free to Choose. He began that series with a 3-minute discourse on the pencil, giving the example of the pencil as a perfect reflection of how the market could create miraculous quotidian objects that are very useful to people. In the TV series, Friedman gave Reed no credit, although in the book, he credited Reed for the story.
And this, you talk about this, Lawrence, in the context of, you mentioned that term miraculous, right? This context of the kind of magic, right, that people give to the free market, right? Or as you put it, I think, like, you know, literal faith, right, yes, in the free market. Yeah, I mean, as if the free market will somehow, you know, it's this almost like this deity of some type that will solve all problems if you just let it function the way it's supposed to.
Yeah, one of the points I tried to make in my book is that critics of the New Deal constantly demean New Dealers for their utopianism, for their being unrealistic. They depicted themselves as hard-headed realists, and you could find so many critics of the New Deal talking about them as daydreamers and, you know, and so forth. But at the same time, these same critics waxed very poetic and very mystical about the force of the market. And Reed's essay is a great example of that because he talks about it. You know, he uses the language of wonders and miracles repeatedly.
Yeah. It's fascinating to me that they're drawing on this kind of almost inevitability, this almost like, you know, providential kind of dimension, right? That the market will solve all problems, but yet they're afraid, right? You know, I mean, it's that tension is there in your book. I don't know if you don't really highlight it, but they're scared to death, but yet they know the free market will solve all problems. But I guess they're scared because the free market's going away, according to the New Deal, and maybe that's, you know, where they're
right. Well, one of the reasons why it's interesting that you say that, I think that's absolutely right. And one of the reasons why I think Reed's essay is so popular is because it really focuses not on the fear, but on the wonder. You know, so much free enterprise discourse highlights fear as much or more than the positive. But Reed's essay is really all about the wonders of the system. And he only talks about the dangers of government obliquely in that essay. And I really think it's one of the reasons why it's kind of one of the most popular documents of the discourse of free enterprise.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of this kind of prosperity gospel kind of, it's all going to happen. Let's go to the 50s and 60s. And let's talk a little bit about, you talk in this one chapter about the way in which both civil rights and labor think about free enterprise. For lack of time, let's focus on civil rights here for a second. You write that civil rights leaders often saw free enterprise, right? That phrase, I'm doing quote signs with my hands right now, as code, right? It was a code for discrimination, a code for maybe even racism. What was it about free enterprise that sort of would have led civil rights activists
to think this? Of course, civil rights activists, I try to show, also tried to, just like Roosevelt, they tried to reclaim free enterprise for themselves.
Right.
But what led them to think it was that a lot of segregationists used the language of free enterprise. You know, people like Lester Maddox, who eventually became governor of Georgia, when his chicken restaurant, when he was ordered to sell his product to all people, regardless of race, he closed his shop down and he said it was an attack on the free enterprise system. And many, many advocates of, segregationist advocates of free enterprise talked about the right of the producer to, decide who they should sell to, that was one of the rights of free enterprise.
We don't have much time left here, Lawrence, but I got one more question. Let's bring this up to the present and talk a little bit. There's still so much more we could discuss, but in your epilogue, you bring Donald Trump into the picture and you think about him in relationship to free enterprise. And you argue that Trump has, for the most part, abandoned this belief in free enterprise, at least as it's been historically understood. What makes you say that, and what does the future of free enterprise in America look like?
That's a great question. And I do think that. And the reason I say that is that Donald Trump is really the first Republican, either president or presidential candidate since Franklin Roosevelt took office, who basically never uses the term free enterprise. And all of my examination of his writings, I found him using the term one time in a very perfunctory way. The 2016 presidential platform of the Republicans mentioned free enterprise also perfunctorily just twice, whereas every other platform mentions it repeatedly. Why is that? Well, I think that Donald Trump is not really a great believer in free markets. You know, he grew up in New York, where the whole idea in the real estate world was to grease the palms of politicians, and he likes to use the market as a place to screw over his enemies and to reward his friends. He doesn't believe in that abstract, beautiful market that Leonard Reed wrote about in iPencil. It's a very personal, not anonymous system for Donald Trump. At the same time, however, the one thing I would say about Donald Trump that marks a continuity is that he is the master of this psychological, emotional language of grievance and loss that we spoke about before.
So Trump, as I'm thinking about this, Trump is more about, iPencil, Reed and others, right? This magical quality, right? Have faith. The market will work out and will benefit us all, right? Trump is much more sort of thinking about this in terms of his ability to forget the kind of fate dimension, or that it'll happen no matter what. He wants to monkey with it, right? He wants to toy with it. He wants to, and usually in kind of rather maybe unethical or whatever you want to call it kind of ways.
Is absolutely.
That what you're
and look
trying
at his presidency.
Here?
You know, he's telling the head of the Federal Reserve what to do.
Yeah.
He says he's calling foreign leaders and telling them what to do.
Yeah.
There's not the sense that the market will solve our problems, that he has to step in and do so.
What do you think is going to happen after Trump? Do you think, this is the new, this is the new way the GOP is going to think about the free market, or what kind of influence you think he's going to have on shaping economic policy in the future for
the GOP? My guess, given how resilient that language has been, that it will make a comeback because it's been associated with the nature of modern conservatism that I have a hard time seeing it disappear altogether. Of course, if we enter a new phase of sort of strongman populist conservativism that, on the authoritarian anti-market side, that may disappear. But I suspect that that the next Republican candidate for the presidency will revert back to the language of previous Republicans.
it struck me just how much, you know, the free market system is this kind of classical liberalism, this faith in progress, right? This enlightenment idea, the inevitability that, you know, liberty and freedom in the economic world will advance. And, you know, you might be right. Trump's kind of just a little bit of a speed bump in this march forward of this kind of free market, free enterprise kind of way of thinking.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think if it's not, conservatism is going to have to really reorient itself around other values. And we see that happening in certain quarters.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, we've been having a great conversation here with Lawrence Glickman. He is the author of Free Enterprise in American History. And how do we find out more about you? You know, do you have a website? How do we get a hold of the book other than the normal places, I'm assuming? But how do we learn more about you and the kind of work
you do at
Cornell?
Well, I'm pretty active on Twitter Larry Glickman is my Twitter handle. And if you go to the Cornell History Department webpage, you could find my webpage there.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, thank you so much for taking some time. I know it's late in the day that we're recording this, so I appreciate you extending your day a little bit for us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
Drew, I thought that was yet another great interview. And what really struck me about this conversation was just how many similarities there are between the ways in which free market advocates made their case, against the New Deal especially, and the way in which kind of populists and conservatives make their case about the demise of American culture today.
Yeah, I am really interested, especially in your question about the epilogue. To what degree has Trump broken something, or is Trump an aberration, right? And I suspect that Glickman is right, in part because of the ways in which, this seems to be the only thing that Trump seems to get resistance from the GOP, But I'm also, it could be very interesting to what degree the next, Republican presidential candidate, if he or she returns to this kind of orthodox position, how many of these kind of rural populist voters will they have lost?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. I mean, in some ways, I love how Glickman frames it, actually, because there's a certain, I've been using all these religious terms, right? Because Glickman kind of really got me thinking about faith in the free market, right? It's like a religious faith almost, but it's a religious faith in some ways with this eye pencil and this kind of magical, I hear free marketers talk about this all the time, free enterprise people, right? Just let the market do its work. Right. It's almost like this sort of economic Calvinism in which we are kind of passive. Right. And the market will just solve all of the problems. But I think he's right. I mean, Trump is like this case study in contingency of free will. Right. Of somebody who wants to monkey with it all. Get in there. And I think he used the term grease the palms. Glickman did, to shape markets according to his own interests in power. So I'm convinced. I mean, as a non-economic historian, I don't know what what someone who really knows about this stuff might think about Glickman's argument. But it seems convincing to me. So yeah, again, another great interview. We're going to be talking a little bit more about some of the things I talked about in the commentary about religion and economics next time with Darren Dochuk. So I'm really looking forward to that one. I hope you enjoyed this episode. And until our next episode, may your way of improvement always lead home.
This has been a production of The Way of Improvement Leads Home, a blog dedicated to reflections at the intersection of American history, religion, politics, and academic life. Visit us at thewayofimprovement.com. The Way of Improvement Leads Home is a member of the Recorded History Podcast Network. Check out the other podcasts on the network by heading over to recordedhistory.net. If you want to support our efforts, please rate and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcatcher of choice. so others may more easily find this podcast. And let's continue the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Follow us at TWOILH Podcast. The podcast is brought to you through the generous support of Gretchen Adams, Richard Green, Margaret Graves, Kate Logan, Lisa DeGuardi, and Ron Schooler. Also, many thanks to our sponsor, Jennings College Consulting, discovering the right college fit for your future. The podcast was recorded at the studios of the Stone Independence School and the High Center Studios of Messiah College. Thanks to Ed Ark for his continued support. Original music is by Overholt. Many thanks to our guest, Lawrence Glickman. Our studio producer is Casey Lehman. I've been your producer, Drew Dearley Hermeling, and your host, as always, is John Fia.
Spin your passion into a business with Shopify and break sales records with the world's best converting checkout. Let's hear that one more time. The world's best converting checkout. Shopify's legendary checkout makes it easier for customers to shop on your website, across social media, and everywhere in between. Now that's music to your ears. Any way you spin it, you can be a smash hit with Shopify. Start your $1 a month trial today at shopify.com/records.